The Metal AI Podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Felix Beecher, and this is the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We talk to a range of top guests, from industry innovators to scientists to philosophers. This is brought to you by Informatech, where I'm the head of healthcare technology. Are there ethical issues raised by medical AI that are unique and special? Any major technological development can have huge benefits and huge risks, and medical AI is no different. The benefits of AI are talked about endlessly, much less so the risks. But what are the dangers of medical AI? I am absolutely delighted to welcome back to the podcast to discuss this Professor Erwin Low, Chief Medical Officer for St. Vincent's Health, Australia's largest not-for-profit healthcare provider, former barrister, member of the Association of Professional Futurists, professor at Monash, Melbourne and Macquarie Universities. Erwin, I don't know how you get the time. Do you sleep? Do you eat? How do you fit all of that stuff in?
Hi, Felix. It's great to be here again and to talk to you. It was such a great time that we had the last time we spoke, and I'm very pleased to do it again. And as you say, you know, I try to find time to do the things that interest me. Right now, it's quite late at night here, and as far as I know, it's early in the morning for you.
Yes, indeed. The reason I wanted to have you back is because it's very hard for me to get people who have a philosophical interest in medical AI, surprisingly. And ethics is definitely an interest of mine. So that's why you're back again talking about ethics. And I know this is a special area of interest. Why don't we talk about what is generally considered to be the cornerstone of medical ethics, and that is the Helsinki Declaration, which is never questioned, but I think is very questionable. Do you just want to say something about what that declaration is?
Well, my understanding is that based off the back of World War II, it's created to address the issue of research, or medical research specifically. So it's not a set of clinical ethics principles, but it's really around ensuring that when we do medical research on human beings, we do it with a strong research ethical framework that includes ensuring that we consent the patient, that the research is necessary, that it is not going to disadvantage any particular group of people, and that we're not doing research on vulnerable groups, which was what was happening prior to the Helsinki Declaration.
That's right. I mean, the Second World War clearly raised very serious and obvious issues about medical experimentation. At the same time, what you've said there about consent and protecting minority groups, that is all uncontroversial. My question, though, you can easily come up with scenarios. Like, let's imagine that there's some kind of brain virus where people are dying by their millions, but there's somebody out there. And if you want to make it really extreme, you could say, you know, they're a kind of serial murderer. But this serial murderer has within their brain a cure for this brain virus. And they, you know, experimenting on him or her without their consent could save millions of lives. It's a kind of classic utilitarian dilemma, right? Now, the Declaration of Helsinki would say, no, we cannot do that because we have to respect the rights of the individual. But this strikes me as being quite potentially problematic. What would you say to that?
Well, we're moving now away from AI into actual ethical case discussions. So
we will come to AI very quickly.
So when it comes to ethics and decision making, it's every case is different. So with your particular scenario, you need to really understand the facts before you can actually make a decision, because there's no there's no such thing as a black and white answer where actually this is, you can always do this or you can never do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because every person's different. And that's the art of ethics when it comes to health. And so in this case, it depends on your ethical framework, right? So as you say, if you hold to the Declaration of Helsinki, which has more a deontological base or intuitionism base, medical ethics base, then it's more around your duty to others. If you are Kantian, or the belief that every human life has value, in which case then you would say no, you can't do it. But if you decide that you want to hold a utilitarian frame, it's one of the consequentialist theories of ethics, and you want to help the greater good, then you could do it. And a good ethicist actually will be somebody who integrates all the different theories together, considers the different types of theories, because your different parts of your brain actually uses the different different types of theory. You integrate it and then you come up with a decision that suits that scenario for that time, right? So it may be actually, if the threat is imminent to the world and this particular serial killer is about to die, right?
Mm-hmm.
You might say, yeah, I'm going to do it, right? But there might be another reason why you can't do it. I mean, I don't know. So unfortunately, Felix, I'm not going to give you a definitive answer, but it really, really depends on the actual case.
I think what I find fascinating here is that the Declaration of Helsinki is a very definite kind of ethics, right? It's kind of rights-based ethics. Whereas if you talk to moral philosophers, probably a lot of them are more consequentialist. They would take a more utilitarian view. It's highly, there's no consensus within the philosophical world, but within the medical world, the Declaration of Helsinki is completely monolithic. It's totally uncontroversial. And I find very interesting.
Yeah, well, it is. I think all ethical theories come across as being like that because they are, by their nature, they have to take a particular framework and perspective, and then you learn the rules of it. In reality, in practice, human research ethics committees actually will weigh up multiple frames, and they occasionally will take a utilitarian position on things,
mm-hmm.
As long as it's still within the frame and it's consistent with respecting people's rights and having a duty of care over their well-being, So yeah, it I've seen that happen. I mean, I've looked human research ethics in my organization or report up to mm-hmm. me. I've been on them. And I've seen it happen like that, where they will take a utilitarian view on things as well.
So you're saying that ethics committees in practice are, they're not made up of philosophers. They're made up of people working on general principles with common sense. Is that fair?
Kind of fair. They human research ethics committees, and in fact, even clinical ethics committees, usually are made up of a mix of clinicians, lay people, ethicists, lawyers. So it is a good committee will be made up of people with different perspectives from different backgrounds, and more diversity, to be honest, the better.
So what I would imagine in general, what would emerge from a committee like that is a kind of mishmash. You're going to get a kind of democratic compromise in terms of ethical viewpoints. Is that right?
Yes, kind of, yeah. I mean, you will get a consensus, but whatever the decision is has to be consistent with basically the Declaration of Helsinki, when it's been adopted by the different countries, all the different research regulators have their own research ethics. So in Australia, the NHMRC has a research ethics basically policy that everybody has to follow in the country when it comes to research on human beings. So they have to be consistent with that. So they will check on all those things, consent, all of those things. There is some room for interpretation.
Now, let's talk about medical AI. I think the fundamental question I'd like to start with here is there anything special about AI-based technologies? This is sometimes called AI exceptionalism, right? Is there anything that unique about what AI technologies bring to medicine from the point of view of ethics?
From the point of view of ethics, you can have two perspectives, right? On the one hand, you can argue actually ethics is ethics. It doesn't matter if it's a human being involved or if it's AI making the decision. The ethical frameworks remain the same because you're dealing with human beings on the other end, and the impact are real on human lives. So on the one hand, it is not different. On the other hand, though, I get the argument on exceptionalism because AI is not human in the end. AI is, with the newer neural networks, AIs that rely on deep learning models, they are like children, actually. So AI becomes more like the need to teach children ethics rather than giving adults a policy. How does one teach a child what's right and what's wrong? So that, if that's the frame that you're taking when it comes to more complex AI models, then it seems a bit more difficult, actually. Then it's not just about coming up with a framework and a set of rules and giving it to the AI, but actually bringing the AI to maturity so that it can think like an ethical human being thinks, not like a human being, because if you make AI like a human being, which has been done now, right, the AI then becomes the average human being who might be biased, racist, sexist, right? So how does one teach AI to be a virtuous human being? That's the challenge.
Now, would you say that medical AI has provoked or stimulated debate in ethics?
It has, actually. So it's quite interesting. With the rise of autonomous machines that have started to take over decision-making from humans, ethicists have started to think about, number one, should we actually allow that? Should we allow autonomous war machines to start deciding who to kill and who not to kill? Should we allow medical AI to decide who to treat, who not to treat, and how to treat? Mm-hmm. And because of the issues, again, of potential bias and the fact that every decision that you make in health, and to be frank, in any other industry, has an element of ethics to it, because sometimes there are winners and sometimes there are losers. And so who decides on that? The classic example, and you'll know this because you are involved in AI, is when it comes to self-driving cars, right? So with self-driving cars, MIT and a lot of Tesla, the engineers, the software engineers are struggling with this very question: is when you have a self-driving car and you're trying to avoid an accident, who does the car hit? Does it hit one pedestrian over the other, the older pedestrian, and avoid the younger pedestrian? Does it try to save the driver? Does it try to save the passenger? Because sometimes it's one or the other, right? So how do you program a car to think like that? Do you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. The people have written articles on it. There was an article that I read by Italian ethicists who proposed that actually in self-driving cars, there should be a knob, an ethical knob, where as a driver, you decide whether you want to be selfless and say, kill me, save the pedestrian, or be selfish and say, kill everyone else, but save me and have you decide.
Are there corresponding cases in medical AI?
At the moment, there are very few completely autonomous AI systems in health that completely bypass human decision-making. I mean, the ones that do at a very low level, we're talking artificial pancreas, AI algorithms that decide on how much sugar you have. You don't need a human to kind of say yes, right?
Yeah.
But when it comes to resource allocation, we're not there yet. I mean, the big examples have been in other areas, for example, social services in the UK, for example, a few years ago.
Yeah.
And now recently in Australia, it was replicated where the federal government decided to use AI to decide who should get social benefits and who shouldn't. And the AI just started making decisions that no one knew the basis of because of the black box nature of AI. And people really had real world consequences. Some people suffered. And it's the same in Australia. I mean, we had the robot debt issue, exactly the same. And so, well, similar. And so, yeah, there can be real world consequences when AI starts to take over decision making that used to be done by humans. And the big problem really is when you don't know why, when there is a black box.
Yeah. Now, you've just given a couple of examples which touch on what I have called the comparison to perfection fallacy. And let me explain. What that means is that people tend to criticize AI systems, but forget that human systems actually suffer from the same problems. Like, let's think about an autonomous machine doing some kind of medical procedure. Now, if I go to my doctor and I say, look, I've got chest pain, I'm feeling tired and exhausted all the time, then what she could do, or he, is look up in a book and it might say something like, how to deal with people with chest pain and tiredness. And then they, step one is take blood pressure. Step two, do a blood test. Step three, send them to an ultrasound, cardiac ultrasound, right? Now, she's not thinking, she's just following an algorithm, essentially. And she may have no understanding at all about why the algorithm exists or you know, the justification for the content of it. So that is exactly equivalent to kind of black box system in an algorithm, isn't it?
Okay, you've raised quite a few points in that bit, Felix, and I'll try to address each. No, this is a great discussion. It's a very important discussion. So in terms of the fallacy, perfectionism fallacy, I think you're right there. I think there is an expectation that AI is being held to a higher standard. So we know that road accidents kill millions of people around the world. So humans are bad drivers anyway. So if a Tesla that's been driven autonomously has an accident, it makes front page news. So, you right. know, it's a big deal. But having said that, I think it's not unreasonable to expect machines to be honest, be better than humans, because that's what they should be doing. Because if they're as good as humans, why switch to machines, right? Because there is a... you have to argue around the economic benefits and all the other benefits of switching to machines. So that's one thing. But the other thing is that machines are better than humans, actually. In many areas, like image recognition specialties in medicine, like radiology, pathology, dermatology, ophthalmology, the models are now better than humans, right? So... And even so, which brings me to the point that you were making about your GP going through a flowchart in the head or an algorithm and saying it's all unthinking. And the interesting thing is this: when doctors go through a formulation where they're trying to, you know, they take a history, they do a medical examination, and then they try to formulate differential diagnosis. A lot of this, as you correctly point out, is unconscious. But it is based on years and years of experience that are completely now in the background. It's kind of like background information that generates. It's kind of like exactly what ChatGPT does, just tons of information, and they come up with an answer. And sometimes they know why, and sometimes it's just a gut instinct based on experience, right? Same thing with AI. Now, the difference, though, in terms of the black box is with a human being, if they make an error, I can go back to the human being and ask them, why did you think it wasn't this? Or they could say, confirmation bias. I thought, you know, pain here means this. And I just went down that track. So they could tell me that, right? With AI, they can't do that. And AI can't say, sorry, I had confirmation bias. I just learned this. With AI, they don't know why they've made the decision. And sometimes it's the same with doctors too, right? They could say, I actually don't know why I did that. And it could be unconscious bias. You know, it could be a black box in the human being too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But a lot of times they do know. I mean, they can tell you. Yeah, it's because of this. And even if they don't know, an outsider could kind of look at the human beings when they explain why they did something, you could tell it. Now, having said all of that, AI researchers are beginning to open that black box. There are ways actually to go behind the neural network to the deep learning, to the way they've learned, to figure out actually this is where the error has happened, and then learn to fix it. So, you know, there's a lot of research around that.
In the case of ChatGPT, there are something like 175 billion parameters involved in that neural network. Now, also, ChatGPT is completely open source. So the fact that in principle you can find out why ChatGPT is coming up with the answers it is, in practice, I would imagine it's pretty much an impossibility. So there's a funny paradox there with the kind of explainable AI.
That's it. I mean, that's one of the ethical principles of AI, actually, explainability, right? But look, it's one thing to have the code of ChatGPT open source. That's like having the human genome or the MRI of someone's brain. It's another thing to know what it has learned from. That it is impossible for a human to go through every single blog post, forum message, you know, Instagram and tweet, because that's what it's done. It's gone through the internet, trawled through every single Wikipedia article. Everything that anyone has posted is read. It is not possible to know if it's suddenly decided to be sexist. Why has it become sexist? You know, has it gone down the dark net? I don't know. Or, you know, has it gone down to this particular website? It would be hard to pinpoint. Similar to why a human has become sexist, could be hard to find out. It could be the upbringing, right? They could have come from a family or whatever, cultural. But with AI, because this is the other thing. With ChatGPT, it only went live like in November. And in that compressed time, it's learned so much and then it started to churn out all this information and it's still learning. And the more it churns out, the more it's asked questions, the more it learns. Mm-hmm. It's constantly evolving. And in that short time, how could one figure out how it's arrived to its own personality? In a human being, it takes, 20 years, right?
Yeah.
So you could, as a psychiatrist, potentially go backwards and try to decide, you know, kind of do some psychotherapy and figure it out. It's hard to do with AI.
You raising psychiatry is interesting. Psychiatry, by the way, psychiatric research was the subject of my PhD. Ooh. And so I'm very much aware that psychiatry is highly problematic in all sorts of ways. Let's take the example of schizophrenia. There are different types of schizophrenia.
Yes.
And some of those are very difficult to distinguish. Sometimes people even discuss whether the concept of schizophrenia is even meaningful. Now, if you ask 100 psychiatrists to diagnose particular cases, there's going to be an awful lot of disagreement. And if you ask one of those why they have come down with one diagnosis rather than another, they probably would say something about why they did that, because it might be very, very murky. They might not be able to tell you what the reasons for that decision was, or they might tell you, but those are not actually the real reasons, and actually they don't really know. That's even worse than a black box, right? That's a kind of, essentially what you have there is people giving you potentially false information. Now, I would imagine that's human beings are probably more prone to that kind of falseness than trained algorithms. What would you say?
I would say maybe. Look, when it comes to diagnosing psychiatric conditions like schizophrenia, in fact, you're probably going to get a lot of agreement on the diagnosis because psychiatrists and doctors use DSM, right? The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Now, version 5, text revision, and it's very regimented. If you have this and this and this, you've got this. You just have to follow it. And so, in fact, it's the opposite problem with psychiatry. People are getting diagnosed with schizophrenia or depression, bipolar, when potentially, just like dementia and Alzheimer's, schizophrenia is not one condition. It's probably 100, right? That's somehow got some symptoms in common. But because we as human beings start to categorize everything, we've created this manual of DSM-5 TR. And so people can be put into pigeonholes, right? So I think that is the challenge, actually, is as we understand psychiatric conditions more and the heterogeneity of the conditions and the causes are, a myriad, and you know, we're learning more and more about it. And I think AI is going to help us with that, actually. AI is going to help us distinguish between the different types of psychosis and help us to potentially find new ways of treating them.
Now, Erwin, you are a Christian, and could you talk a little bit about how that influences your personal approach to ethics as a physician?
It's a good question. So first thing to say is that, yes, I am a Christian, and clearly being a Christian is a big part of my life and has made me who I am in terms of my own personal morals and values. Having said that, being a doctor, being working in health, I also need to separate my own personal morals from my work, in a sense that, of course, I will be free to conscientiously object to certain things, but then I would also need to make sure that my own beliefs do not interfere with the care that I do of the patients and the people that I look after. So the interesting thing about ethics is that, in fact, if you look into it, there are three levels. You've got personal morals at one level. So you and I, because of our upbringing, our family background, our culture, have got values that are personal to us that we believe in that are strongly held. So people of faith might have that. But then those values may or may not be different to societal ethics. Mm-hmm. Ethics are basically rules that society has decided these are the right things to do, the wrong conduct. And then when society decides to formalize those rules so that people are punished if they break those rules, they become laws. And certain things that are lawful may not be ethical, and certain things that are ethical may not be lawful. So those are three levels. So what I'll say is that, and one thing I'll say to all healthcare workers is that you need to be sure of your own values. You need to ensure that you don't breach them, because they are what makes you a person. But you also need to make sure that your own values do not interfere with the care that you provide to your patients as well.
Okay. Now, when it comes to medical AI specifically, does your Christian perspective somehow change your view of the ethics of medical AI?
So in short, no, basically, because as I was referring to before, the ethical frameworks that AI needs to work within are the same as the frameworks that humans have to work within, because it's not about who is making the decision. It's about the impact of those decisions that the impact will have, right? So the people, we're talking about human beings, and therefore there does need to be some kind of ethical framework that is logical, rational, and that is acceptable to society that AI needs to operate in, just like we expect humans to operate in. So I don't think there is a difference. And I don't think that it makes a difference if someone has a Christian background or Muslim background or atheist background. AI still needs to work within an ethical framework.
I've really enjoyed the conversation, Erwin. Look, there is, however, one question which I always ask guests, and that is, if you had to pick out your favorite example of medical AI, what would that be?
I mean, there's so many examples of AI in the real world.
That's why it's a good question.
It is a great. I mean, I'll pick AI that appears to have the potential to revolutionize primary care, because I think that has a big impact on the way the health system would operate into the future. So people will know that in the NHS in the UK, they are trialing the Babylon AI app. The NHS has a partnership. Well, you are in the UK. You know this, actually.
Yes. Felix.
Yeah. So they actually did a study to compare Babylon AI with general practitioners and in terms of the accuracy of their ability to diagnose medical conditions. Mm-hmm. And that Babylon AI system was able to score higher than 72% of general practitioners in the UK, which means that it's in the top 25% of doctors when it comes to diagnosis. I think that's spectacular. And I think the fact that, number one, the NHS has the courage to trial it in production in real life. Number two, the potential for it to address the shortfall in primary care doctors that we have around the world, because not medical students no longer want to be GPs. Mm-hmm. And number three, it's a good use case and a test for AI in the health system, where it can start off with primary care, really, you know, and diagnosis and doing the screen and potentially refer the patients to the right specialist. Mm-hmm. But from there, it can start to then expand into other areas of medicine. So I think that would be my example.
Now, you use one word there, which is especially interesting, and that's courage. Why do you think it required courage for the NHS to introduce this trial?
Well, I think it requires courage because health is a very risk-averse industry. There is a very low appetite to introduce anything novel or different because of the fact that we deal with human lives. Mm-hmm. And so, not many other health systems have decided to do something like that. Of course, they have AI integrated in EMR as providing decision support, but this is about putting in a system that could potentially replace GPs, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, they would have risked the ire of the BMA, the doctors' union, in special interest groups, and all of those. But yet they went ahead. And I think that's fantastic. The NHS, to be honest, is a bit of a pioneer when it comes to AI. I mean, you know, you've got that Eric Topol report from a couple of years ago. That's fantastic. I mean, not many health systems have gone that far to try to do a review and look into the future like the NHS has.
Owen, 1,000 thanks. I have enjoyed our conversation immensely. I'm very grateful to you.
No worries, Felix. It's been a pleasure. And until next time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye then.
All right.
Thank you for listening. I'm Felix Beecher. Ping me on LinkedIn for more information on Omdia's services in healthcare technology. See you next time.